Specialty Radio. Addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingraham Show.
It's beginning to look a lot like Christmas everywhere you go. Take a look in the 5 and 10, glistening once again with candy.
Greetings. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare. And I'm standing in today for the great voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. Reach us at lauraingraham.com. You can tweet Laura at IngrahamAngle. And you can call in to us today at 855-405-2872. Or you might like to remember it is 855-40-LAURA. And I'm so glad to be with you today, but I have to let you know Laura's dad is ill, and Laura and her family have gathered around him, and our prayers are with him. I'm sure yours are too. Laura, if you're listening, we're all there with you. Meanwhile, it's PC Thursday. PC meaning political correctness, of course, and political correctness is taking over the world. It's replacing common sense. It's pushing aside science. It's replacing dignity. Wait until you hear some of the most shocking examples this week. You know, it begins with a six-year-old boy kissing a little girl's hand. Is that six-year-old boy a sexual predator? We'll be back to talk about that in just a couple of minutes. And later in the hour, is President Obama, who is sworn to defend the Constitution, actually shredding it? How much danger is our nation in? This was the subject of a House Judiciary Committee hearing just a few days ago. And we're going to be talking about how much of a crisis are we in with this president destroying our Constitution. And later in the show, we're going to be talking to Steve King about that, congressman from Iowa and a member of the House Judiciary Committee. Also, later in this hour, we're going to be talking about the subject closest to my heart, superbugs, hospital infections. Are hospitals becoming so dangerous that it's not worth going to the hospital? Is it actually destroying our ability to seek modern medical care? 10 years ago, I launched a national campaign to stop these hospital infections. And I'll be discussing what you can do to protect yourself and asking why aren't hospitals doing the obvious, like cleaning up better after the germs that are left behind by one patient lingering on bed rails and chairs and medical equipment ready to infect you when you go into that room. And get ready for our third hour, because we're going to be having an Obamacare town hall. Many members of Congress are going to be avoiding those town halls when they go home for the Christmas break, but we're going to be having one right here, and you are the guests. So please be sure to call in at 855-405-2872 and let me know what your Obamacare experiences have been, what Obamacare is doing to you, and what you'd like to do to Obamacare. But first, the top news of the day, deficit decadence. I'm sorry, folks, that's what I've got to call it. Many people are trying to sell this budget deal to you as Christmas candy, but it's not. The Ryan Murray budget deal should be called deficit decadence. It claims to reduce the deficit by $23 billion. Do not be bamboozled. Deficit reduction is not what this country needs. We need spending reduction. And we've lost a lot of that in this deal. Remember back in 2011 when the president signed a deal for a so-called sequester, meaning mandatory spending cuts year after year after year? It was called the Budget Control Act of 2011. But unfortunately, this deal will give away the control. That's right. This deal that the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, has pledged to ram through the House in the next 36 hours, well, he's doing it so Congress can go home for the holidays. But what this deal does is remove those mandatory spending cuts that we fought so hard for 2 years ago and replaces them with frivolous, I can't apply another word, that's what it is, unbelievable, lacking in credibility, promises of future cuts down the road. Now, I'm going to ask you a practical question. Imagine if your spouse showed up in the driveway with a shiny new car, a car you can't afford, and said, "Don't worry, honey, it's paid for. I redid the grocery budget 10 years down the road." You'd send your spouse down the road to return that car, and pronto. Well, that's what they're doing with this budget deal. In 2011, Congress agreed to let the president borrow, hold on to your hats while I tell you this figure, $2.1 trillion, trillion with a T. And in return for permission to borrow all that money, the president promised the sequester, mandatory future cuts in government spending over the next decade. But in the third year of the deal, he's demanding that the sequester be over. He got his money and he spent it. But now he's unwilling to abide by the cuts that were put into place as part of that deal. It's a shell game, let's face it. Politicians never keep their word. I feel betrayed. I know some very powerful people in Washington have thrown their support behind this deal, saying it's the best we can get. Grover Norquist, a man I admire tremendously, head of Americans for Tax Reform, says it's a B-plus deal. We ought to go along with it. The Wall Street Journal says it's probably the best we can get. But you know, folks, we've been settling for that kind of nonsense for too long. And the result is that our children and grandchildren are now facing $17 billion in debt. And contemplate the fact that the speaker is insisting that everybody vote on this with just a few hours' notice, not really being able to read it. That's the Washington way, you know. Don't read it. Just follow what the boss tells you to do. Here's the bottom line. The biggest threat to our freedom is government spending, because the more government spends, the more they take out of our pockets or the future savings of our children and grandchildren. If you work all day and you have to give the money to government instead of deciding for yourself that you'd like to recover your sofa or take your kids out to dinner or go on a vacation, you are not free. And right now the federal government is spending 22% of GDP, 22% of everything all of us earns going to work every day, 22% of the fruits of our labor. And when you add in state and local government spending, it's 42%. And now here is the big question. Do you get 42% of your happiness from government? I know I don't. So send a message to Washington that this is not the way to do it, that we need real spending reform. And give me your thoughts, 855-40-LAURA, 855-40-LAURA. And Steve King's going to be on to discuss this with us at 10:30. Also in the headlines, and this is a quickie because then we've got to wrap up for a moment, the House Oversight Committee turned up letters yesterday showing that the Department of Health and Human Services has ordered private contractors not to cooperate with congressional investigators or hand over any documents regarding the malfunctioning healthcare.gov website. What are they afraid the contractors will produce? So much for government transparency. We're moving into the era of George Orwell, 1984. Government speak, deception, and the end of freedom. But don't despair, because after the break, we're going to discuss political correctness, and you're going to have a few good laughs at the expense of the political pundits and mainstream opinion leaders. This is Betsy McCoy on The Laura Ingraham Show, the voice of freedom. I'm proud to be standing in for her today.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Oh, come, all ye faithful, joyful and triumphant, oh, come.
Call the Laura Ingraham Show, 1-855-40-LAURA.
Oh, jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun.
Glad you stayed with me, Bubba, and keep jingling. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York, author of Beating Obamacare, and I'm standing in today for the voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at lauraingraham.com. You can tweet Laura at IngrahamAngle. And you can call us at 855-40-LAURA. I'm so glad to be with you today, and we're talking about political correctness. Let's call this PC Thursday, because political correctness is literally taking over our lives. Here is the prime example. I couldn't believe it when I heard about this. A little six-year-old boy in Colorado. He's in kindergarten at the Lincoln School of Science and Technology in Cannon City. I'm not going to be hesitant about naming the school because shame on them. He's in reading group, and he reaches over and kisses a little girl also in his reading group. And for that, he was labeled a sexual harasser and suspended from school. Listen to how little Hunter Yelton describes the experience.
We're doing a reading group. And I mean, no one kissed on the hand. That's what happened.
This is taking it to an extreme that doesn't need to be met with a six-year-old. Now my son's asking questions. What is sex, Mommy?
How can you be a sexual harasser if you don't even know what sex is? And, of course, what six-year-old really does? But is this part of the war on men? Has it become a war on little boys? In the next hour, we're going to be talking with a real expert on this, James Taranto from the Wall Street Journal, who has investigated the lack of due process. That's certainly what Hunter Yelton experienced. The lack of due process on college campuses, where any heterosexual man who has a sexual experience with a young woman on the campus, and who doesn't in this day and age, they are all doing it, is at risk of being labeled a sexual predator and being expelled. There is no due process. A young woman who decides she was unhappy with what happened the night before can file charges, and literally there's almost no defense for the man. So if you're sending your son off to college, you might have to recommend that he experiment only with girls who live in town, or go to another school, because you don't want him being thrown out for doing what used to be called, you know, college shenanigans. It's really a shame. And thank the Obama Civil Rights Department for this, because in April of 2011, a bureaucrat named Russ Lynn Alley, then Assistant Education Secretary for Civil Rights, issued a directive to all schools that they had to come down hard on any sexual misconduct. And I guess that's the story, the real story, behind what happened to little Hunter Yelton. Kissing that little girl was politically incorrect. You can bet that if she had kissed him, you never would have heard about it. Speaking of political correctness, how about not being able to discuss the weather anymore unless you want to inspire fear in everyone? After all, the only way we're supposed to talk about the weathers these days is to talk about the perils of global warming. but I've got a lot of facts here I'm eager to share with you, and they've all been in the news this week. But the global warming fearmongers have chosen to ignore them. Here's one for you. The 2013 hurricane season just ended was one of the five quietest years since 1960. Pretty interesting. Or how about this one? Arctic ice increased by almost a third this past year, while the ice at the South Pole was thicker and wider than it's been in 35 years. Or how about this one? They discovered that in Antarctica, where the ice is melting on one end of that continent, it's not because of global warming. It's because of newly discovered active volcanoes under the ice. We're going to take a break in a second, but when I come back, we're going to have a lot more to talk about, Bobola, a lot of facts about these global warming myths. Here are a couple more. Just 5 years ago, the head of the International Panel on Climate Change told Congress that the Earth is running a fever. Hey, call Obamacare. The Earth is running a fever. And yet, these global alarmists are now refusing to even hear the other side of the story. The Los Angeles Times has even announced that it will no longer print letters to the editor questioning man-made global warming. Wow. They don't even want the truth to get out. So Obama's environmental policies, they're not based on science anymore. This is the only place where faith is allowed to intervene in government, at least under the Obama administration. Their environmental policies, well, you could call them faith-based, not science-based. Just last week, the president announced, this is amazing, announced that the government will be expected to get 20% of its electricity from renewable sources. Now, just a second, guys. We know that wind and solar and whatever, seaweed, he's got that on his list. He's the pond scum president. These renewable sources aren't renewing enough. They aren't producing enough. And they are extremely costly. But even now, when the Defense Department is being shrunk and we're imperiled, the Defense Department is ordered to get its energy from these renewable sources. Is this political correctness? No, it's political craziness. I'm going to be back after the break with a couple more, and then on to the constitutional crisis affecting all of us. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the great voice of freedom. Great voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. Give us a call. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back, Bubba. Glad you stayed with me. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. And all I want for Christmas is my freedom back. Santa, would you please bring President Obama a stocking stuffer, a copy of the U.S. Constitution, and maybe you could underline those laws, underline those words, quote, laws be faithfully executed. For those Constitution mavens listening, of course, that's Article 2, Section 3. Yes, we are facing a constitutional crisis. You've probably got your own thoughts on this. Give us a call at 855-40-LAURA or reach us at lauraingraham.com. Just a few days ago, the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on the president's refusal to adhere to the Constitution. His duties are defined in Article 2. He is supposed to faithfully execute the laws. But in fact, even though he's a constitutional lawyer, he's ignoring the Constitution. He's governing like a dictator. And his latest ploys, well, we'll talk about those in just a second. But first, I want you to hear the words of Professor Jonathan Turley of George Washington University. He voted for Obama. He professes to agree with Obama on health care and other issues. But he did not mince words when he testified before the House Judiciary Committee.
How does the president's unilateral modification of acts of Congress affect both the balance of power between the political branches and the liberty interests of the American people?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The danger is quite severe. The problem with what the president is doing is that he's not simply posing a danger to the constitutional system. He's becoming the very danger the Constitution was designed to avoid.
Boy, that's pretty sobering, isn't it? He's becoming the danger the Constitution was designed to avoid. And that's exactly what he's doing, because instead of executing the law, he wants to perform the functions of both branches of government, Congress and the president. Several law professors and policy experts at this December 3rd hearing laid out like a long list, a litany, of the president's constitutional transgressions. Of course, I can tell you about the ones affecting Obamacare the most. Gone is the employer mandate, perhaps never to reappear. Gone is the cap on out-of-pocket expenses. Gone is income verification replaced with a wimpy version agreed to during the debt ceiling crisis. Gone are over half the deadlines in this law. Gone is the provision that insurance companies have to provide a specific kind of one-size-fits-all government-designed health insurance plan. Of course, we find that obnoxious, but it is in the law. And once all of those things were ripped out of the law by none other than the president himself, he padded it with 1,472 waivers to specific unions and companies in his favor. And then he weaseled through a special deal for members of Congress so that they don't actually have to pay for their own health plans, although the law says something quite different. So when you hear the president say, the Affordable Care Act, it was passed by the House, passed by the Senate, signed by the president, approved by the Supreme Court, that may be true of the 2,572-page law sitting on my desk, but it is not true of Obamacare, the, quote, health reform, close quote, he's trying to roll out. That is a mangled, distorted, obviously illegal version of what Congress actually enacted. So Turley was one of many people at that House hearing who warned us that we are in what he called, in his own words, the biggest constitutional crisis of his lifetime. I invited Sheila Jackson Lee, the congresswoman from Texas, to come on this morning because she really ripped into members of the House Judiciary Committee on the Republican side for even holding the hearing. She said, this is a wasteland. This is just politically motivated. And what worries me, what should worry everyone in the nation, is that some members of the Congress are so partisan or so cowed by the president, so scared of the president, that even though they've taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, they're going to ignore his repeated violations of the Constitution and let the Constitution go by the wayside. The fact is, anyone who serves in government has an obligation to leave our system of government intact when they leave office. But this president certainly isn't doing that, and neither are the members of Congress who are too afraid to speak up and object to his violations of the Constitution. And by the way, it's not just health care. Take a look at the immigration law, right? He tried to get through Congress his version of immigration reform or his version of a so-called DREAM Act, which would have provided amnesty to illegal immigrants who are brought here as children. And, of course, many of them do evoke sympathy, and maybe we should do something like that. That's for Congress to decide, all of us to decide. But the fact is, it is not for the president to decide. He is not the lawmaker. And yet, when Congress refused to pass such a thing as the DREAM Act, he simply rammed it through with regulation. That is unconstitutional. Or how about environmental regulation? He tried to get through Congress very rigid rules, very costly rules against coal-fired plants. He couldn't do it, so he rammed that through with regulation. Regulations that are going to bankrupt or likely bankrupt that industry. So one of the questions that came up at this hearing is, what should we be doing about this? And one of the most important issues discussed was that members of Congress are actually not permitted to sue the president when he tramples on their lawmaking authority. So you have to rely on somebody else to bring a lawsuit. Well, the trouble is too many businesses, for example, are afraid of the president and unwilling to litigate. Another example of that came up just recently. This is really a classic for the president. There's something in the Obama health law called reinsurance. It's a fee that all large employers who self-insure or buy insurance plans for their employees have to pay, $63 a head the first year. And the money is going to be used to help people with pre-existing conditions. That's the short version of this very long and complex law. But the fact is, the unions objected. And so at the last minute, just a few days ago, you will find in the Federal Register on December 2nd, snuck in there, the kind of weaselly rule that exempts certain unions from what the law clearly says they have to pay. And the language used in this Federal Registry entry is particularly disturbing. It says, quote, "Our continued study of this issue leads us to believe that this provision, that is of the Affordable Care Act, may reasonably be interpreted in one of two ways. It may be interpreted that these unions have to pay or don't have to pay the self-insurance fee." Well, that's just a lie. The Affordable Care Act's provision doesn't even use those words. It's clear the unions are supposed to pay. And yet, the army of bureaucrats cranking out these regulations and deceptions to justify the president's power grab, well, let me remind you, they're not loyal to us. They're not loyal to the public. They're not loyal to the U.S. Constitution. They're only loyal to, quote, the state and the person who occupies the White House at that moment. Writing that kind of government double talk is a dark art. It's straight out of George Orwell's 1984 novel. In that novel, Orwell warned that totalitarian governments impudently claim that black is white. Over and over again, they claim whatever is true is the opposite of what's actually true. And they do it, contradicting the plain truth, to sap the public's ability to think critically. It's mind-numbing. And this is what the Obama administration is doing, lying to destroy our freedom. And yet, will the other companies that pay more because the unions are exempted, will they sue? No. They're going to be too afraid to sue and object to this perversion of the law because they're going to have their own hands out. They're going to be looking for other ways to make up the difference. They're going to be looking for their own side deal with the administration. That is what's happening. The Obama administration's cronyism is corrupting the nation. And the biggest loss is our freedom. Each time Obama claims power the Constitution does not allow, he is menacing. He is menacing our freedom because future presidents will be able to rule by the same edict instead of ruling according to the U.S. Constitution. This is a very troubling development. And we're going to be talking with Steve King, congressman from Iowa, later. He was at the hearing. But the real issue here is, when will Americans speak out clearly for the Constitution? I know all I want for Christmas is my freedom back. So, Santa, please bring President Obama a copy of the Constitution and underline those words in red, that the laws be faithfully executed, because that is the president's job. President Obama is not king. The rule of law is king in this country, and we've got to make sure it stays that way. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham on The Freedom Show. Laura, the great voice of freedom, I'm proud to be standing in for her today, and our thoughts and prayers go out for her dad, who is sick. She has gathered around with the family to support him, and we're all thinking about her. When we come back from the break, we're going to be talking about hospital infection, superbugs, the issue closest to my heart. Give us a call. You've probably had a terrible experience or know someone in your family or someone in your neighborhood who has. 855-40-LAURA. Call us and tell us what you think ought to be done about those superbugs, and I'm going to give you some very important information. If you're going to the hospital soon or at this holiday season, everybody goes to visit loved ones at Christmas time. In the hospital, we want to make sure that you don't bring some dangerous superbug home to your own family. This is Betsy McCoy. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham on The Freedom Show.
Christmas future is far away. Christmas past is past.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Present is here today.
Sleigh bells ring, are you listening? In the lane, snow is glistening.
Welcome back, Bubba. Glad you're listening. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the great voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA or lauraingraham.com. And bringing things a little closer to home, let's talk about superbugs. Washington definitely does not know best when it comes to protecting people from hospital infections. Sadly, one of the reasons this is such a big problem is that they have done so little. But these hospital infections kill more people in our country each year than all the cases of AIDS, plus all the cases of breast cancer, plus all the auto accidents combined. Over 100,000 deaths a year. And believe me, that is an undercount, because so often, as you know, when a loved one goes into the hospital, say for a hip replacement or for a valve replacement, or for any reason, even a happy reason like having a baby, and contracts a deadly hospital infection, the infection isn't listed on the death certificate. So it's definitely an undercount. But whether it's one death or 100,000 deaths, it's a needless tragedy. Almost all of these infections are preventable through proper procedures and mostly through cleanliness in hospitals. And just to put on my other hat, that's why I founded the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths. When I was Lieutenant Governor, people came to me with all kinds of health problems. But increasingly, it was the same terrible story, that they had brought a loved one to the hospital and never brought them home again because that person, that patient, had contracted a deadly hospital infection. And of course, now the biggest infection in the country is something most people hadn't heard about 5 years ago, Clostridium difficile, or C. diff for short. And with this infection, it's hard to know what's worse, the dying or the lying. Because the fact is, hospital personnel tell patients and families that antibiotics are to blame for C. diff. The real culprit is inadequate cleaning in hospitals. No matter how many antibiotics you're on, if that C. diff germ doesn't enter your body, almost always through your mouth, by the way, you're not going to get C. diff. Here's what really happens. You're in the hospital as a patient, and these C. diff germs are invisibly on almost every surface, the bed rail, the call button, the over-the-bed table. You touch one of those surfaces, And then you swallow that germ. You touch your lips or you eat food and you swallow that germ. And after this break, we're going to really get into this because this is one of the biggest tragedies in our nation, C. diff. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura. Give us a call, 855-40-LAURA. This is your healthy radio addiction.
Your healthy radio addiction starts now.
Power to the people!
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Silver and gold, silver and gold. Everyone wishes for silver and gold.
Well, silver and gold, but we're not talking about Obamacare health plans, although they use those fancy labels for that very low-quality insurance offered on those exchanges. This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the great voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. And you can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet her at Laura Ingraham. You can, at Ingraham Angle. And you can call in and tell us what you think should be done about this major killer in the United States, hospital infection. This is a time of year when we celebrate, when we're happy, but we also go visit loved ones in the hospital. My advice, forget the flowers and the candy. Bring a canister of bleach wipes and wipe down the surfaces right around your loved one's bedside. You could be saving a life. Because the major reason for these hospital infections is inadequate cleaning. The germs are all over those surfaces, the bed rail, the TV clicker, the call button, the over-the-bed table, the telephone. In one study, it was shown that if you want to eat your lunch, the cleanest place in a hospital room is the toilet seat. Better there than on that over-the-bed table where they actually deliver the patient's food. There was a time when hospitals routinely tested the surfaces for bacterial load, but in 1970, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the American Hospital Association issued a joint dicta or proclamation saying, stop all that testing. If a patient gets an infection, we'll give them an antibiotic. Well, that was very bad advice. And now, of course, many antibiotics don't work, and hospitals are inadequately cleaned, and patients are paying for it with their lives. But if you wipe those surfaces around the bed, you could be saving a life. Robert Ornstein at the Mayo Clinic found that wiping the surfaces around a patient's bedside once a day with a Clorox bleach wipe reduced C. diff 80%. 80%. So why isn't every hospital in the United States cleaning rooms that way? You see people coming in with a mop, right? That's just for show. The germs on the floor aren't what's going to kill you. It's the germs lurking right there next to you on your bed rail. The germs you pick up in your hand and then allow to enter your mouth. They deliver your food tray, but they don't let you clean your hands. There's no way to. You can't get out of bed. So the Committee to Reduce Infection Deaths is trying to do something about this. Come to our website, hospitalinfection.org. We want you to have the information to protect yourself if you're going into the hospital. And we also post hospital infection rates and how to get them for hospitals in at least 28 states in this country where the state government has required hospital infection reporting. The fact is, and I'm a big booster of American health care, you know that. But on this one issue, the U.S. is so far behind. For example, the CDC has allowed the most dangerous bug of all, it's called CRE, to rage through hospitals in this country. It first appeared in 1999 in North Carolina, just one incident. And then there were several large outbreaks in New York City hospitals in the early part of the last decade, but the hospitals kept quiet, and the CDC did virtually nothing. And now this germ is in at least 43 states. The mortality rate, if you go into the hospital and you pick up this germ, you're at least 50% at risk of dying from it. That's right. You can't fight it. There are no antibiotics that really treat it. If you get a CRE bloodstream infection, your risk of dying is 70%. When this germ invaded Israel, by contrast, they didn't wait a decade to do something about it. They responded with a military-like effort, and in 1 year, they reduced it 70%. That's right. They insisted all hospitals report. They tested all patients. They invoked all kinds of rigorous cleaning. That's right. They reduced it 70%, but here in the U.S., year after year, it spreads and spreads in nursing homes and hospitals, killing more people. And the CDC can't even tell you how many people, because they haven't even reached out to state governors and health departments and lawmakers to insist that this become a reportable disease. Can you imagine a disease with that kind of death rate menacing our hospitals, and the CDC is doing so little about it? But you can do something about it. You can flood the Capitol with calls on behalf of your loved ones. We are not going to be able to take the risk of going to a hospital if the threat of infection is so great. Even the CDC's Tom Frieden, the head of the CDC, admitted that this is so dangerous that people are going to be reluctant to get hip replacements or cancer, chemotherapy, or other treatments, because if they get an infection, they can't be saved. It's very sad to see. The fourth largest cause of death in the United States. We've got to do something about it. When we get back, we're going to talk about another issue that's a real bee in my bonnet, and that is the war on men on college campuses. And with us will be James Taranto from the Wall Street Journal, who has done one of the best pieces of investigative reporting I've ever seen. He had a piece in the Wall Street Journal last weekend called Taranto and Education in College Justice. And he's going to be talking about what happened at Alabama's Auburn University. But the lesson is clear. Young men, when you go off to college, if you have sex with a woman, you may be labeled a rapist. And you won't even have due process to defend yourself. So when we get back, James Taranto from the Wall Street Journal. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. This is your Healthy Radio Addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Merry bells keep ringing.
Jingle bells, jingle bells, jingle all the way. Oh, what fun it is to ride in a 57 Chevrolet. Jingle bells.
Welcome back, Bubbleheads. Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingraham, the voice of freedom. And we're going to be talking about kangaroo courts in this segment. With us is James Taranto, a member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board, and he writes the Best of the Web Today column. And he has done a really fantastic piece of reporting revealing the travesties of justice, the injustice on college campuses. Welcome, James Taranto.
Thanks. Good to be here.
What happened to Josh Strange, the student at Auburn University in Alabama?
Well, Josh Strange met a girl about 2.5 years ago. They hit it off. Their relationship moved very quickly. She almost immediately moved in with him, and things went along fine for about a month, at which point they had a disputed sexual encounter one night. She called police. They both gave statements. They both agreed on the physical details of what happened, but she said she had awakened to find him forcing himself on her. He said that she had initiated the sexual contact. It was completely consensual. She did not press charges. She returned to his apartment that night. They agreed to continue dating, but as you can imagine, this relationship did not last very long. And after the breakup, she accused him of approaching her in a public place and striking her, an allegation he denies completely, and she filed charges with him for both the sex incident and the punching incident. The grand jury cleared him of the charges were forcible sodomy. They didn't even find probable cause to prosecute, and he went to the trial for the simple assault for the alleged punching, and she didn't even show up in court. So he was completely cleared by the criminal justice system, but he had already been expelled by Auburn University in a trial, a proceeding of which I obtained the recording. I think I'm the first journalist ever to obtain a recording of one of these collegiate proceedings, and it was just outrageous. It was like a Soviet-style show trial run by circus clowns.
Boy, that's really amazing. So he wasn't able, did he have a lawyer with him in the trial? In the so-called
trial? He had a lawyer. The accuser also had a lawyer who turned out to be the city prosecutor, the same guy who was prosecuting him on the simple assault charges. His name is Michael Short. But the lawyers were not allowed to speak except to introduce themselves at the outset.
And he was pretty short on evidence, right?
Yeah, well, the tribunal was presided over by a librarian. The members of the panel were two students, a college staffer, and a fisheries professor. I didn't even know there was such a thing as a fisheries professor. Basically her case consisted of calling up two Auburn administrators, one of whom was a so-called safe harbor advocate. That's a concierge for purported sex crime victims. And the other one was was the Title IX coordinator, the anti-discrimination enforcer for the school. Both of these ladies testified as to her that she was credible and that she told a very compelling story. Now, keep in mind, that would never be admissible in a court of law. You can't have a third party say this witness is credible. The jury makes up its own mind about the credibility of witnesses. And then the Title IX coordinator, whose name is Kelly Taylor, the librarian, Tim Dodge, who's presiding over the hearing, asks her, what are some examples of behaviors of people who might have been the victims of sexual assault? So because this is he said, she said, there's no actual evidence as to what happened. They're trying to infer what might have happened from her behavior. So here's what Kelly Taylor, this professional anti-discrimination person, says. Quote, first, they frequently cry. Second, their storytelling is sometimes disjointed, sometimes not. And third, and she goes on at some length here, there's often a lot of emotion inserted into the story that is about being very upset or in disbelief or unsure what to do next or petrified. So the third one is just a reiteration of the first, that they frequently cry. You know, they're emotional.
Right, but in other words, there's no evidence against this fellow Josh Strange at all.
Right. The accuser's case consisted entirely of an appeal to authority. The authority of these two ladies who, you know, it's clear when you hear what they have to say. The safe harbor coordinator, Susan McAllister, said she didn't even know what the accuser claimed happened. She said, as a safe harbor advocate, I don't need to know a lot of details, so I didn't ask her to go into a lot of details.
So the presumption, it sounds as if the presumption is that anyone who emotionally accuses a young man or a man of any age of sexual harassment or sexual assault is presumed to be telling the truth.
That's right. Kelly Taylor's position, her testimony amounts to a claim that in principle, a woman's tears are sufficient to establish a man's guilt.
Wow.
That's a pretty great feminist principle, isn't it?
So these are kangaroo courts. And is this happening in other campuses? I read an article by Kathy Young in Reason Magazine, and she was talking about it happening at Vassar and other colleges.
Yes, it's happening all over the place. Partly because campus discipline systems have always been rather amateurish. You know, they normally don't, or in the past, they haven't handled what amount to serious allegations of criminal wrongdoing. But the Department of Education, particularly under the Obama administration, has been pressing universities to crack down on sexual misconduct.
To crack down on it, but right when they conduct a hearing, to rely on, quote, a preponderance of evidence instead of the kind of innocent until proven guilty standard that we use in a real court of law.
Well, the usual standard at colleges for most disciplinary infractions and before April 11 for these sorts of infractions was clear and convincing evidence, which is somewhere between beyond a reasonable doubt, the standard in criminal cases, and preponderance of evidence, which is the standard in civil cases. But, yes, the Education Department ordered schools, and this isn't just universities, by the way, it also applies to elementary and secondary schools, to use a preponderance of the evidence standard, which basically makes it impossible for you to, for the defendant to exercise his right to remain silent. Remember, too, that Joshua Strange was facing criminal charges. So, and the prosecutor was there in the room.
Wow.
So that anything he said, could have been used against him in the criminal, case.
But, you know, being expelled from a college for sexual assault, that can ruin your life.
Yeah. Now, it didn't ruin Josh's life. Let's point out that he's now attending the University of South Carolina upstate, living with his parents. The administrators there have been very supportive. After my piece ran in Saturday's paper, they called him in for a meeting with the dean of students on Sunday to offer him whatever support they could give. So, you know, hats off to those guys for being more decent than your typical college administrators. But, yes, an expulsion is very expensive. Josh's parents were paying out-of-state tuition. I think he has a very strong legal claim.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Can't he sue? Can't he sue? And aren't some young men in other college campuses who have experienced this kind of kangaroo justice, aren't they suing?
Yes, there are a number of lawsuits. Josh has a particularly strong case because Auburn is a public university, and public universities are required to give due process to the accuser. Now, I asked Auburn if they're confident that they meet that standard, and their reply was, "We're confident that all students get notice and a hearing," which is a reference to a 1975 Supreme Court case, Goss versus Lopez, that set the standard for high school students facing a 10-day suspension.
Wow.
It's an unresolved legal question how much due process adults in college who are facing a more serious punishment are due. But I say this could be a very good test case to find out.
You're right. James Toronto, thank you so much. You have really opened our eyes. I'm sure many parents of college-age men are listening and will be very alarmed by this. Thank you for joining us. And, folks, when we come back, we're going to be talking with Steve King, the congressman from Iowa, about the injustices, the gross violations of the Constitution committed by the President of the United States. He was at the House Judiciary Committee hearing on December 3rd when law professors from both sides of the political aisle presented a litany of crimes that the president has committed against the U.S. Constitution. And he will be guiding us on what members of Congress can do, what citizens can do. He may even raise the I word, impeachment, which I know some of our callers have been asking about. And so when we get back, we're going to be doing that. But in preparation for that, I'd like to remind everyone that the principles here go way back to James Madison, and we'll be talking about him after the break as well, the great James Madison. And I'm Betsy McCoy, standing in for the great Laura Ingram, the voice of freedom and the healthy radio addiction. Welcome back, Bubbleheads. Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare, and I am standing in for the great voice of freedom, Laura Ingram. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, and you can tweet Laura at Ingram Angle. And we are talking about what all of us want most for Christmas. We want our freedom back. And we are unfortunately challenged by a United States president who does not take his oath of office seriously. He has sworn to defend the United States Constitution. Article 2, Section 3 of that Constitution says he is to faithfully execute the laws. But he hasn't been doing that. He's been making them up. And so, just a few days ago, the House Judiciary Committee held a hearing on how much of a crisis this is. And you heard earlier Professor Jonathan Turley from George Washington University School of Law, who is a Democrat, who voted for the president, who professes to agree with the president on many issues. And he was one of several constitutional experts at the hearing who warned that this is the most serious constitutional crisis of his lifetime, that, in fact, the president's conduct is exactly what the Constitution was designed to prevent, that this poses a danger to our freedom and to the future freedom of our country, because this president is grabbing power that correctly and historically and according to the letter of the law belongs only to Congress. And in a moment, we're going to be talking with Congressman Steve King about that. But in the meantime, one of the most egregious examples of the president's violation of the Constitution, and probably one reason why Congress hasn't spoken up more, is that the Affordable Care Act, Section 1312D, provides that members of Congress have to enroll in Obamacare. Now, traditionally, members of Congress have gotten these very fancy federal employee health benefit program plans, and they've gotten them paid for largely by the taxpayer. Taxpayers have picked up 75% of the cost in the past. But now, under the Affordable Care Act, the letter of the law says that members of Congress and their staffs have to enroll in Obamacare, and it doesn't say anything about anybody paying for it except those members of Congress and their staffs themselves, unless they're eligible for a subsidy. And I don't think a member of Congress earning $174,000 a year base pay is going to get that kind of subsidy. So that is probably one reason why they haven't objected to the deal that the president weaseled through. But before we get to that, we are very privileged to have on the line one of the great members in the United States Congress, a friend of liberty and someone I consider a good friend of mine, Congressman Steve King. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Betsy. And I count you a great friend. You traveled to Iowa to stand up for the Constitution and liberty. And we all appreciate you. I'm glad your voice is out there across America today.
Well, thank you. And I want to hear your thoughts about this hearing, because I know that Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee from Texas called the hearing a wasteland and a waste of time. What's your view?
Well, I'm just left hearing now, so I need to ask you, which hearing are we addressing?
We're the House Judiciary Committee hearing on the president's constitutional transgressions.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's... funny that I walked out of one just now. I just stepped back to call you on one that addresses that kind of on the margins with regard to asylum. But the one we had last week is the one you're referring to.
That's right.
And it was, I think, Betsy, the best hearing that I have been in my 11 years here in Congress. I have drafted a resolution of disapproval of the president's unconstitutional activities and listed a number of the things that he's done that are, what should I call them, extra-constitutional, unconstitutional, is more accurate, and it's better to be more blunt. The hearing had excellent constitutional professors who answered our questions directly, and we were able to explore a whole gamut of violations of the president's, violation of his own oath of office that he take care that the laws be faithfully executed. He has ignored laws. He has amended laws by executive edict. He's implemented taxes that he didn't have the authority to tax. He's collected money he didn't have the authority to collect, and he's spent money he didn't have the money to spend. And so as we walk through a whole series of these, we know that there are about five different constitutional violations with regard to Morton memos and immigration. You can count more than I can in Obamacare, but there are at least three of them that are very clear. The clearest of all is when the president extended the employer mandate for a year, when we know that the law says that the employer mandate shall be implemented in each month after December of 2013. That's also true without not quite exactly the same language, but exactly the same meaning for the individual mandate. And then he extended the small employer mandate and delayed that for a period of time. He has no authority to do any of those three. He needs to come to Congress and ask Congress to change the law if that's the policy that's going to be changed. And when Congress passed legislation to conform, when the House passed legislation to conform to the president's unconstitutional edict, the president said, if it reaches my desk, I will veto it. How arrogant can a man be to violate the Constitution, take onto himself the Article I, the legislative authority of Congress, and then when Congress seeks to give him a constitutional avenue and end the policy that he seeks, threaten to veto it because Congress surely shouldn't usurp its own authority and take it back from the president who had taken it from us.
So what should Congress do about this? What is Congress capable of doing about this to halt this violation of the Constitution?
Basically, that's a topic that I've drilled into that thing, and maybe more than anybody else on the committee. And we went through a checklist of things Congress can do. And, you know, the first answer is, well, Congress has the power of the purse. Well, it's the power of the purse. You saw how that worked when we went through a government shutdown. President Harry Reid held their ground, and we need 218 House members that would stand, do a blood oath, and never blink. Maybe, just maybe, you could get the Senate and the president to go along. But I think it's pretty well proven, at least in this era, kind of the power of the purse for Congress doesn't control a president.
Really disappointing, isn't it? Really disappointing.
It is. And I think the president now knows this. I think he knew it going in. But now I think he's concluded that he is empowered more, because now he doesn't fear the threat of a shutdown. That will color our budget negotiations going forward and Obamacare implementation going forward.
And the debt limit issue, too.
And the debt limit. And if the president, well, let's see, the things that the president has done that control that Congress has. So let's just say, and we can come back to it, but let's just say they're the power of the purse that Congress has is ineffective, at least in this arena, and probably will be for some years to come. Then you can go to court and litigate. We have done that. And in the case of the immigration, we came back around to the circle. We ended up, the catch along the way is we used ICE as the plaintiff that had standing, and ICE's appeal then needs to essentially go to the administrative process of the Justice Department. So the immigration constitutional violations essentially go into the hands of Eric Holder to resolve on behalf of ICE. You know how that works.
Yeah, good luck with that one.
Then elections was another way to resolve this. And elections may resolve it if you have free and fair and honest elections. But we also have the president using the IRS to punish his political enemies and muzzle his political opposition.
And Obamacare navigators to draw people into the political process and register them to vote.
That's right. So he's using taxpayer dollars to promote the sign-up of people that will vote for Obama. He's violating the Constitution by sweeping thousands and hundreds of thousands of people into the United States and giving them a legalization status, which is illegal in the first place, and then now pushing, of course, for amnesty for them so that they can vote. And when you look at those newly arriving immigrants, they will vote at least 2-1 for Obama and his party. It may be as high as 5-1, depending on which polls you look at. Betsy.
So violating the Constitution to create a permanent Democratic voting majority.
That's exactly what's going on. And so if you can't get resolution in the courts, you can't get it through Congress having the power of the purse. If you can't get it through the election process because it's being subverted by these tactics that they're using, and you can't message it any longer with 501c3s and 501c4s because the IRS will go in and punish and muzzle, then the next answer to this gets to be pretty murky. There's always the question of impeachment that comes up. That was part of the discussion, too. I was sitting in this Judiciary Committee room not very far from where I stand right now for 3 days in 1998, December 7th, 8th, and 9th, listening to the impeachment proceedings that took place here in the Judiciary Committee. And I will tell you that this Congress doesn't want to go through that again. And I think you can look at Harry Reid over in the Senate and know how that would work.
Right.
So almost all of our options
could change after
right
the 2014
now,
election.
Well, it could. It could. If we could have a dramatic election result and win the majority in the United States Senate. But who's to say that a president that would legislate by press conference? I mean, he has no authority to legislate anything. But for him to step up at a press conference and announce this is the new law, and he's done that, and I could go back to it if we need to, why would a president then who has such contempt for his own oath, such contempt for the Constitution, has no restraints on him, why would he honor a decision of the House and the Senate? Why would he honor a decision of the court? What do we do if he continues to disrespect all of the constitutional constraints and shape this country under one-man rule?
Well, it's very frightening. It's a very frightening prospect that you've laid out for us.
And it's real. It is so real that when we hear this come through this committee hearing, I was pleased to see how many Republican members of the House Judiciary Committee were astute on constitutional issues that questioned the witnesses and pulled in and pulled these answers out. I thought that I didn't have as many allies as I actually do, and I'm really proud of my colleagues here in the Judiciary Committee and the House.
But this hearing can't be the end of it, right?
It can't be the end. There's another way. There's another piece of this solution. And it's the American people have to understand what's happening. And they have to rise up. And they need to press everybody in this country to put an end to this extra-constitutional activity on the part of the president. When Democrats fear they will lose their seat in Congress for defending a president who violates his own oath of office repeatedly, that does start to shift things. And it's the same with Obamacare. When we went through the shutdown and the government was opened back up again, I said then, we've used most of the tools in our toolbox as Republicans here in Congress. Now it's up to the American people to rise up, and it's up to Democrats to start to call for the repeal of Obamacare. When that first one does so, for fear of losing an election, then I think the dam might break.
Well, Congressman King, you are a great American. You have laid out the issues for us. We want to follow you and rise up. And I thank you for giving us your time. I know you were very pressed for time, so we're honored to have you on today.
Pleasure to be on with you. Thanks for all you do, Betsy. And I'm going to go back there and carry out my
fight
duty.
For freedom. Thank you.
Will
when
do.
We
thank
get
you.
Back, we're going to be talking a bit more about the superbugs, because I have a list of things for you that will save your life or save the life of someone you truly love. So stay with us. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for the great voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. You can reach us at lauraingraham.com. You can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle. That's a tricky one for me. Laura at Ingraham Angle. And this is your healthy radio addiction.
The Laura Ingraham Show.
Rocking around the Christmas tree at the Christmas party hop. Mistletoe hung where you can see every couple tries to stop.
Oh, I love that song. So glad to be with you, Bubala. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State, author of Beating Obamacare, and feeling like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer today with all this great music. Standing in for the voice of freedom, Laura Ingraham. Her dad is ill, and she has gone to be with him, and our prayers are with all of them. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA, and you can tweet Laura at Ingraham Angle. And we've got a caller on the line, Eddie.
Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to call up, and I heard your interview there with Steve from Iowa, and I've been following that guy for a long time, and I just want to tell you how much I appreciate you letting him get out everything he said, because no other network will let him talk like that. No other network will spread that truth the way he did, and he put it on there just right. It's just plain, simple, in your face, and that's what it is. That's exactly what's happening here, and you're not going to get that out. And I watch MSNBC. I watch Chris Matthews and Rachel and Lawrence O'Donnell. And I watch Bill
O'Reilly.
Well,
you got to change the channel if you're watching MSNBC, because you aren't going to get the truth on that channel.
yeah, but I know the enemy. I know
yes,
what
that's
they're.
True.
I know the left wing, and they are my peers. They are my peers. When I was in Vietnam, they were protesters. When I was, answering the call of government, they did not. And they want to now they're running the show. And, we're in Vietnam fighting communism. They didn't want to go. And they didn't. And now they're in charge.
And they are denying the challenge. They are denying the danger that we face. And Steve King is absolutely right. It's time for the people to rise up and demand that this Constitution be protected and enforced for future generations. Thank you, Eddie. Yeah, we're looking forward. We've got another caller on the line.
Hello?
Yes, thank you for calling. It's Betsy McCoy.
Oh, yeah, hey, thank you. Good day. I hope everything is okay. I have to disagree. I mean, I understood what the congressman was saying. I'm hearing that from the senators, and I'm hearing that from the congressman. They're telling the truth, but you know what? Not a daggone one of them is doing anything about it.
You're right about that. I don't want to cut you off. We're coming up to a hard break, but I'm glad you called, because the fact is we all want more to be done about it. Coming up next, Laura sat down and spoke with a country star, Josh Thompson. And after the break, we're going to hear that wonderful interview. So even though Laura is out today, you'll have a little with her. Bye-bye.
Well, you know Dasher and Dancer and Prancer and Vixen.
Comet and Cupid and Donner and Blitzen.
But do you
love that Christmas music? This is Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York and author of Beating Obamacare. And I'm standing in for the great Laura Ingram, the voice of freedom. You can reach us at 855-40-LAURA. You can tweet Laura at Ingram Angle. This is your healthy radio addiction. And I promised you an Obamacare town hall, so give us a call and tell us what Obamacare is doing to you and what you'd like to do to Obamacare. Here's what the president promised.
The product is good. The health insurance that's being provided is good. It's high quality and it's affordable. People can save money, significant money, by getting insurance that's being provided through these marketplaces.
Well, don't believe him. And don't be bamboozled. First of all, the premiums on average are 41% higher than comparable care last year. But worse than that, because when you're really sick, as much as you have to worry about money, what you're worried about the most is getting the right care. And here is the information that is slowly leaking out. First, you won't be able to use the doctors and hospitals you currently prefer if you sign up for most of those exchange plans. Because to keep the premiums from spiking even higher, the insurers offering plans on those exchanges have cut out most of the doctors and hospitals. You won't go to Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles. You won't go to Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Hospital in New York or to many other of the top drawer places. Nope. And that's what you need when you're seriously ill. So you won't be able to use the doctors in those hospitals either. And there's new information out now that if you have a chronic condition like AIDS or MS, you probably won't be able to get the drugs you currently take as part of your new plan. So we're going to be talking a lot more about this after the next break, but we have a special treat. We have Herb London, president of the London Center and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He is one of the top experts in the world on foreign policy and national security, and he's going to tell us right after this break what we should conclude about this deal with Iran. It looks to me like it's a giant step closer to allowing Iran to become a nuclear power. But you can hear it from the expert himself, Herb London, right after this break. Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction. Welcome back, Bobola. It's Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of freedom, Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction. And I'm so pleased to introduce Herb London. He is the president of the London Center for Policy Analysis, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He has a resume that's about 2 miles long. Let's suffice it to say he is a top expert on foreign policy and national security. And he's going to give us the lowdown on this proposed agreement with Iran. Dr. London, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Betsy. Always a pleasure. And you're doing a great job, by the way.
Thank you. Having a blast. Okay, so tell us, why should the United States go along with this?
Well, frankly, I don't think we should. I think this is nothing more than an extension of the Obama campaign. He was great fanfare, we'll say. He fought about peace in our time, a kind of Neville Chamberlain-like peace. What we have is the Iranians are permitted to maintain control over the fissile material they've already produced. So they're not giving up anything. They are freezing additional production. And in addition, we are going to release something on the order of $7 billion of assets, Iranian assets that have been frozen. So what do we get out of this? This is the first stage. This is presumably an act of goodwill. But in response, we already see that Pakistan has probably sold nuclear weapons to Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is saying, we're out in the lurch here. we thought that we could rely on the United States' American nuclear umbrella in order to protect us against whatever Iranian assertions are likely to take place. That is no longer the case. So you have proliferation that has been put in place. You've alienated Israel as well, that is fearful about an existential threat to its very existence. And so now we are put in a position where our allies don't trust us. And, of course, we have engaged in this rapprochement with Iran, which is designed in large part to appease an American nation that is war-weary and that feels the president of the United States is blundered in one way or another. This is his way of recapturing the American public and securing his base of support within the Democratic Party.
But I should think that friends of Israel in the United States would be very, very upset about this. After all, Netanyahu called this agreement an historic mistake.
Well, it is a historic mistake, and from Israel's point of view, it's an absolute disaster. The question, however, is what will members of the Congress do who have been pro-Israeli supporters? I mean, the key figure in this is Hegel. He caved on the Hegel appointment to the Secretary of Defense position. Now the question is, what is he going to do? My guess is the following. The United States will secure from Iran a statement that is probably very bland and somewhat innocent of appearing, in which they say, no longer will we be making any threats to Israel. And that will be the cover that will provide the Schumers of the world from saying, well, we can support this deal because it's better to engage in diplomacy than war.
But is Iran's word good?
Of course not. I mean, Rouhani, the same fellow who we're negotiating with at this moment, and the president of Iran, is the same fellow who's been negotiating for the Iranians on nuclear deals over the last 10, 15 years. So it's exactly the same cast of characters with the same goals in mind. Their goal is a Shia crescent. For them, nuclear weapons are not merely a military weapon, but a political weapon, a weapon that gives them great influence over the course of events in the Middle East.
And this is the Ayatollah who denounced Jews as rabid dogs?
Well, it's not only the Ayatollah who has done so. Other imams have done so as well. And they have said time and again that Israel should be wiped off the face of the map. When you make claims of that kind, obviously you're going to make Israel very nervous.
Is this going to...
Of course, it's... Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I don't want to interrupt you. You're the man with the information. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say the key, of course, is how Israel will respond. Israel could respond militarily. The problem, of course, is refueling and the logistics of a campaign against Iran. On the other hand, the Israelis internally have their own political problems to worry about and whether, in fact, they could develop a sufficient consensus to attack Iran. On the other hand, Israel is also in the odd position of maintaining a very ambiguous nuclear policy, in which they say we will not admit to having nuclear weapons and we will not deny having nuclear weapons. Well, at this point, if you want a deterrent, you're going to need a deterrent that has credibility. Israel might very well have to change its nuclear policy and say, we have 150 nuclear weapons, we have missiles that have 2,500-kilometer range, we can reach every Arab capital and certainly every Persian capital, and we are now very much alarmed about what is happening. Now, that is a very different nuclear posture. Whether the United States may like it or not, Israel may be forced in a position where it has to assert itself in this way.
That's right. And I noticed when I was reading George Will's piece on this, he seems to be more of a friend of the deal than you and I are. He was arguing that Israel's air force is too small to strike over the distances needed. But you disagree with that, right?
Well, there are a couple of factors here that I think are somewhat imponderables. It's very odd to even think of Saudi Arabia and Israel being allies. But sometimes the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Oh, you've
Saudi
been
Arabia
in politics, Herb. You know that.
Well, I certainly do. You know that Saudi Arabia now has refueling capacity. And they may say to the Israeli Air Force, look, take your F-16, fly them over Saudi Arabia. We will provide the refueling that is necessary so you can engage in this attack. Keep in mind that if there is an attack on an Iran, it will be very limited. There's only so much that the Israelis can do. The various nuclear facilities are dispersed throughout Iran, and it's very, very difficult to hit all of them. If anything, you set back nuclear enrichment for a period of a year or two, not much more than that, and hope during that period that there is a regime change. But there's not very much that could be accomplished in eliminating all of the nuclear facilities. Keep in mind that even in this deal, it's very interesting and virtually unnoticed that Parchin, the area in Iran that houses all of the major missiles, is not included in the surveillance opportunities for IAEA. And that means that, in fact, if they wanted to weaponize, they could probably do so. With the fissile material that Iran has at the moment, that is at 20% level, they could probably produce a few Hiroshima-like bombs. So if they wanted to weaponize, and that will obviously be the key, they could do so. They also have missiles that have a range of 1,500 kilometers, so they could reach Israel very easily.
So
this is a very, very real problem for Israel.
So, Herb, one final question. What happens next in the United States about this deal?
Well, I'll tell you what I think is going to happen. I'll speculate now on phase three. We're in phase one now. By phase three, I think the United States would be saying to Iran, you know what? Freeze your nuclear capabilities at the present level. Even if you have some enrichment at the 80% level, which would create a very, very significant bomb. And if you want to produce some in your plutonium, your heavy water project, continue to do that as well. But, do not weaponize. This is a solution not unlike what you've seen in Japan, where Japan has fissile material, but because of Article 9 in the Japanese Constitution, they cannot build nuclear weapons. So they don't weaponize those weapons. They have missiles, they have bombs, but don't put them together. This will be the solution that Obama will say, we have brought about. We have put Iran in a position where they will not weaponize their nuclear weapons. This is a much safer period for the United States. We've reduced tensions in the Middle East. With great fanfare, he will say, I've brought about a new era in Middle Eastern politics and a new era for the United States and Iran.
You mean he's trying to retroactively earn that Nobel Peace Prize?
That is correct, and he will do so with great fanfare. There will be some sort of speech, either in the State of the Union or an additional speech, where he said, I am capable of bringing about a reduction through diplomacy that we could not bring about militarily, and that this is a much safer period for the United States. Of course, this is all bogus. It'll be a much more complicated period for the United States, and we will lose the support of many of our allies and, in fact, bring us closer to the brink of war. That's why I described it as a Neville Chamberlain-like peace, a peace where people think it's the illusion that some sort of stability has been created when, in fact, we have brought about great instability in the Middle East.
Very sobering warnings, Herb. Thank you so much for sharing your enormous expertise with us. Herb London, president of the London Center. In the remaining time,
pleasure to be with you.
Thank you. In the remaining time, I just want to tee up this Obamacare town hall because I know that so many people are desperate to hear the truth about these exchange plans. So many people are losing their individual coverage, and beginning in the new year, many, many millions of people with employer-provided health insurance are going to lose it too, and they will be forced to reconcile or deal with these exchanges. So right now, what I'd like to do is say, call us if you need information about Obamacare. Tell us what you'd like to do with Obamacare. And in the meantime, let me remind you that if you have a pre-existing condition, if you're in one of those high-risk pools that 35 states currently provide, you're going to be dealing with the closing of those pools very soon, and you're going to need advice on where to go next. And we'd like to help you out. So, with that in mind, I wanted to just mention that there's lots of new information out about how restricted the lists of drugs you can get in these exchanges are, and you really need to investigate a plan before you sign up for it, because if you have AIDS, if you have Parkinson's, if you have MS, if you're going through chemotherapy, it's highly likely that the drug, your drug regimen, your physician has recommended may not be on that formulary. That's what they call those lists of drugs available. And in these exchange plans, it means not only will you get a smaller reimbursement, you won't get even a nickel reimbursement. You will have to foot the entire bill yourself. So that's a real concern on these exchange plans. Not only can't you keep your plan and keep your doctor, but you may not be able to keep the life-saving medications you currently need, and it's going to require a lot of investigation on your part. When we come back after the break, hit me with your questions on Obamacare. I am ready and willing to help. This is Betsy McCoy standing in for Laura Ingram on your Healthy Radio Addiction.
Oh, the weather outside is frightful, but the fire is so delightful. And since we've no place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
The Laura Ingram Show.
Glad you stayed with us, Bubbleheads. Betsy McCoy, former Lieutenant Governor of New York State and author of Beating Obamacare, standing in for the voice of freedom, Laura Ingram. This is your healthy radio addiction, and we've got Rick on the line. Rick, are you still with us?
Hi, yes, it's Nick, Betsy. Just nice to hear from you.
Isn't that nice, Nick?
You must guest on shows.
Thank you.
Yeah, the thing I first I wanted to see what your comment was on Tom Price's health care solution, but you also asked us what our solutions were, and I think health care is real simple. You have people in jobs, and you have people who aren't, and i.e. the earned income. Why wouldn't it just be the first amount of income anybody makes, whatever their salary is, deducted with the purchase of at least a catastrophic policy, and those that do not have a job, who are like earned income tax credit people, if they are going to get a $6,000 credit from the government, why wouldn't you just take out $2,000, $3,000, whatever it is, for a policy for them? And therefore, almost everybody is insured. The only fool who would not get insurance would be somebody making a salary, yet, you know, I don't know why they wouldn't know tax policy, but they would say, it doesn't make sense financially for them to pay taxes when they could deduct part of that.
Well, let me answer this, Rick. I'm really glad you've been thinking about this. And first of all, my general approach is compassion, not compulsion. I want to help the needy and leave everybody else to make their own decisions. So I don't believe in the government requiring people to have health insurance. But I certainly want to help anybody who needs help buying it. I do believe that Tom Price has a good program, but I'd like to add a few things. Most of the Republican program is about making health insurance more affordable, and that's an important goal that the president has not achieved. In addition, I'd like to actually protect the people with pre-existing conditions. They get clobbered the worst under Obamacare, and the reason is that the people in 35 states who are now in high-risk pools, those pools are closing, and instead they're going to be dumped or forced to go into these exchanges, which are like Medicaid. You don't have access to the highest quality hospitals, the specialists. Imagine being in the middle of chemotherapy and having to change oncologists and change hospitals. So I believe that the federal government should take that money and instead provide block grants to the states to fully fund these high-risk pools so the neediest people who have the sickest health conditions can get coverage. And secondly, for the industrious, who lose their coverage because they lose their job and they're temporarily uninsured, give them help paying their COBRA premium. Give them a subsidy for a short period of time. So I'm glad you called. It gave me a chance to talk with you about this. And we've only got 2 minutes left on the show, or I'd love to chat more with you. But in closing, I'd like to suggest that if you're a baby boomer, line up your doctors now, even if you're healthy, because if you wait till you turn 65 and go on Medicare, you will not find a doctor willing to take you on as a patient. And if you have things you confide to your doctor, as most of us do, talk with them about keeping two sets of books, because under this new Obamacare system, you don't have privacy. The Department of Health and Human Services actually said in the Federal Register, if you want privacy, pay cash. A pretty sobering warning. You know, it's important that we defeat Obamacare and replace it with something better, something that truly will help the needy. But even more important than defeating Obamacare is protecting this little book here I have on my desk, the United States Constitution, the finest work of mankind. And I'd like to say in closing that Madison said in Federalist 62 that the biggest danger is a president who exceeds his power. He warned 200 years ago for Congress and the American public to be vigilant against that kind of executive overreach. And he also warned against laws that look like Obamacare, 2,572 pages. He said, it's pointless for Americans to elect a Congress if Congress in turn enacts laws so voluminous they cannot be read or so frequently changed no one knows what the law is. This is the Freedom Show with Betsy McCoy, and we must all stand up for our freedom. I'm proud to stand in for the voice of freedom, Laura Ingram. Thank you.